Hey, welcome everybody. We're starting a new series today called Thriving in a Strange New World. And I got to get you some throwback, some retro as we start. You know, when I was a kid, we grew up with Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock and all the gang. And it started, and I've heard this introduction about 4 million times, Space, the Final Frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. It's 5-year mission, which has now gone on for over 55 years. It's 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life, a new civilization, to boldly go where no one has gone before. And this has been around so long. I grew up in that and then went to Strange World. Now they have another, I think this is the 38th spinoff of Star Trek, and it's actually called Strange New Worlds. Never seen it, but it's out there, whatever. So on one of these episodes, I want to take you, one of these episodes in Star Trek, they go to this really crazy, funky planet where there's this crazy landscape, and it's like, how in the world is that even possible? Is that somebody built that? And take another look at it here. This is kind of this crazy landscape, and it's like, that is really amazingly cool. And you know what's even more cool? Is that this strange new world is not on Star Trek. I've been there to this actual place, to this place. There's people in this photo. Here's another one with a person in the photo. I've been on that very spot. It's called the Giant's Causeway, and it's in Northern Ireland. And what's the really crazy, funky thing is that everything you're seeing here is not human-made. It is a completely, naturally occurring phenomena. It looks like somebody stacked up all these things, but actually it happened naturally. Apparently, volcano or something, and the water hits the volcano and it crystallizes the rock into these crazy hexagonal shapes, of which there are millions on this northern shore of Northern Ireland. I've been there. And guys, when I stood there in that place, I thought, I am in a strange new world. I couldn't imagine in my mind that someplace would actually look like this, but it exists. And it's like, I got to take a picture of this, and I got it. And it was just a strange new world. In the United States, there's really one place I think of, maybe you've been there to this one, and it's the Badlands in South Dakota. I remember going there as a kid and then going there later in life. And just, I mean, there's many photos of it, but this one, it doesn't look real. It looks like something out of a science fiction thing or we're visiting another planet. It is a strange new world. Well, guys, I'm going to talk to you about that today. Strange new worlds and thriving in a strange new world. Because, guys, there's sometimes, as we think about the cultural landscape that we now live in 2024 and counting, we look around and we go way back to the year 2000. It's like, is it true, Grandpa, that you were born in the 1000s? Yes, I was. I was born in the 1000s. Yes. So you go way back to 2000. Here's the thing. I mean, life has changed a lot since 2000. You used to be able to carry water onto an airplane. Now you can't do that anymore. It's not allowed. You used to be able to, you know, to wear shoes just walking through the air. Now you got to take off your shoes. We got these crazy devices. They're absolutely everywhere. We carry them with us. I mean, you know, they were unheard of, you know, not that long ago. And now everyone has one. Even in some of the poorest countries on earth, everybody has a cell phone. Nobody carries a camera anymore. I mean, a few people, like professionals, but most people just take photos with their cell phone. And why do we call it cell phone anyway? The phone on my cell phone is a seldom used app. I clearly don't make phone calls all that often. I do a lot more on this phone than telephone calls. That's what we used to call them, kids, all right? The other day, somebody asked me for Isaac's phone number. I didn't know it. Why? Because I haven't had to recall it for years. I just hit a button. I don't have to remember his phone number. Kids, we used to have to remember everybody's phone numbers or look them up in a phone book. The world has changed radically, and it hasn't been all that long ago. Even if you weren't born in the thousands, you might have been born in the 2000s, but life is different. And on a cultural landscape, we think about all the ethical, moral challenges that we face as a culture. We think of all the polarization and politicization of things. We think about all the competition and the harshness and the social media wars that are going on, and for the canceling and for all the crazy stuff that we can't believe is happening. And sometimes you say, you read it and you're like, is that like a meme or is that real life? And you're like, well, am I living in some kind of strange new world? And the answer is yes, you are. And even if you don't get swept up in all the cultural stuff, there's just everyday life. And it's like, really? This is what I'm doing now. Life can be so challenging. And if you've ever come to that point, it's like, slow down, I want to get off, or just, I'm living in this strange, crazy world. Please help me. I don't want to just survive. I would like to actually live my life. I would actually like to thrive. And if that's your heart, then this is going to be a great series, because we're going to spend the next 14 weeks going through an incredible book called The Book of Daniel. Daniel was a prophet about 600 years before the time of Jesus, and he has a fascinating story. His entire life, over 70 years, are captured in the book of Daniel. The first half of the book of Daniel is kind of a biography of his life that he either wrote himself or he compiled. And then the second half of the book is a book of crazy apocalyptic visions. The book of Revelation gets a lot out of Daniel, until I thought, you know, why not do something absolutely crazy because we live in a strange new world? Let's walk through the book of Daniel, and guess what? We're going to get great wisdom from the Word of God to help us guide our path through these very challenging, crazy days. Because I'm telling you right now, Daniel lived in crazy days. He lived in a strange new world. He was a man from Judah, okay, the southern kingdom of Israel in about 600 BC. And he has something very dramatically bad happen in his life. And that's where we're going to begin at the book of Daniel, chapter 1, verse 1. We're just going to give a little intro and overview today of life, and then we're going to delve into it in a much greater way in next weekend and in the Sundays to come, okay? So let's look at it. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and laid siege to it. Okay, yeah, another, you know, kind of interesting, boring beginning to a Bible book. Are you kidding me? Guys, this has to be, for an opening line of a book, it has to be the most bummer, downer, terrible beginning to a book. If you are a Jewish person, 600 years before Jesus, and this happens to you, it's really, really, really bad news. Because King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon is the king of the world. I mean, he is the big man on campus of the world's superpower, Babylonia, and he is top dog. And he is picking off kingdoms after kingdoms after kingdoms in his military conquest. And then one day, he decides to set his eyes on Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel. Northern kingdom's long gone. They've already been conquered. The southern kingdom's holding on for like 125 years. But their day has come, and this very, very bad thing happened to them when Nebuchadnezzar and his army pulled up and surrounded the gates of the city of Jerusalem. The year is approximately 605 BC. We know that with fairly great certainty because of other archaeological findings and historical records. It was the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim, who was a very bad, evil king of Judah. God kept warning them for decades and even centuries to turn. They didn't. They kept worshiping false gods. And so finally, King Nebuchadnezzar, the culture just keeps declining down, 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 down. He came to Jerusalem and laid siege to it. This is absolutely the biggest bummer of a beginning of a book you can have. It's like, this one is when our country came to an end. This is when disaster happened. This is absolutely catastrophic. It's terrible. Are you okay? Are you getting the feeling here? So Daniel, at this time, is a 15-year-old kid living in Judah, following God, but he didn't ask for this. He's a good kid. But guess what? The big bad King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon surrounds their city, lays siege to it. And if you read about it, which you can in 2 Kings 24 and 25, it was really, really bad. People laid siege. They surround it. They won't let anything in. No food gets in. People are starving to death. Terrible, terrible things happen in sieges, in cities, and it happened to Jerusalem. And King Nebuchadnezzar begins a wave, three waves of deportations, eventually conquers Jerusalem, completely destroys everything, completely carries off articles that Solomon, who centuries before had built and put articles in the Holy Temple of Jerusalem, and they all get taken away. I mean, this is like, I don't know, you know, it's like the capital of the United States gets completely surrounded and they destroy everything and carry off the most famous articles, the Declaration, the Constitution, all this stuff. It's all gone to some foreign power and they do away with your king and your country is basically over with. Bummer. But God has a different perspective. Verse 2 tells the God-size side of this. The Lord handed King Jehoiakim of Judah over to him. What? God did this? Like the absolute worst thing that could ever happen? God did this? Well, he'd been warned about for centuries. Okay. But it finally happened. And the hand of God is upon all, even these catastrophic, terrible things. God's still in control. And this is the viewpoint of Daniel and the faithful people of God to say, even in the worst of our days, God is sovereign. And the Lord's hand is still at work. In fact, it was the discipline of the Lord that caused this to happen. And we're not going to talk about that a lot today, but that's what was happening. And he says, the Lord, that's the God of Israel, handed King Jehoiakim of Judah, southern kingdom of Israel, over to the terrible, evil, superpower King Nebuchadnezzar, along with some of the vessels from the house of God. The house that God told Solomon to build, he allows it to be ransacked, and the most sacred objects to be carted off. Nebuchadnezzar carried them to the land of Babylon, to the house of his God, and put the vessels in the treasury of his God. It just spoils a war. It's just Nebuchadnezzar ticking off another country he now owns. But the Lord is behind all of this. And what looks like the absolute, I mean, how humiliating is this? Your temple ransacked. But it says here, it didn't just happen. It was the Lord who handed it over to King Nebuchadnezzar. The Lord causes some to rise, some to fall. He's in charge of all history. Okay, keep going. The king, that is Nebuchadnezzar, of Babylon, which was a world power and had pagan gods and disgusting religious practices and all sorts of terrible, evil things that went with their pagan religion and society. He ordered Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the Israelites from the royal family and from the nobility, young men without any physical defect, good-looking, suitable for instruction in all wisdom, knowledgeable, perceptive, and capable of serving in the king's palace. So you can read all about this in 2 Kings 24 and 25. But basically, King Nebuchadnezzar knows how to build his empire. And he says, you know what? There's some really smart people. And there's some really strong people. And there's some really sharp people. And you can read about it. He took some of, well, the cream of the crop, the absolute best workers, the smartest people, the most brilliant engineers, the royal family, everybody who was all that in Judah is gone. He's taken them for himself to build up his empire because he's a smart guy. He didn't get to be king of the world because he was a numbskull. He knew what he was doing. And it's like, I've got all the best of all these different countries, nations I've conquered, and this is one of the best. And I'm going to take the best of the best, and I'm going to make them Babylonians. And they're going to be amazing. And we're going to have an amazing empire we're going to build. So he picks the cream of the crop. And here, there are many others, thousands of others. But here the story focuses in on basically Daniel and three friends, whom we know by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We'll get to that in a minute. And he says, I want these guys to serve in my palace. They're not out in the street somewhere. They're not working in a factory. They're not working making clothes. They're serving me. They're going to be near me, like kind of close to the cabinet, you know, that I've got here. This is what I'm going to do. And it says he was to teach them, this chief officer, was to teach these young men who are just the cream of the crop, the Chaldean language and literature. In other words, he is to fully enculturate them. Use another word, indoctrinate them. Use another word, brainwash them. Whatever, however you look at it, you're going to become fully Babylonian. Now, check out these videos. We're not going to hear them. You're just going to see some of the photos here. But this is the Ishtar Gate from the ancient city of Babylon. Babylon was destroyed eventually. It no longer exists. It is near Baghdad, but it's in ruins now. The actual artifacts of the Gate of Ishtar, which was one of many gates. It's such a beautiful and amazing artistry that's here and craftsmanship. It happens to now be in Berlin of all places, but that's where it is. It was taken out of there in the early 1900s, and it was transported to Berlin. And you can go and see that there today. So, wow. And this is an incredible culture with tremendous architecture. And for their day, technology and literature. I mean, they had a thriving civilization. It was all that. And they said, we want to just introduce you to this incredible culture that we call home and that we'd like for you to call home. At this point, there's no cruelty here. It was a cruel siege and terrible thing, but at this point, they're wining and dining them. In fact, it says, the king assigned them the daily provisions from the royal food and from the wine that he drank. This isn't some wine off the shelf at, you know, a liquor store someplace in Babylon. This is the king's own wine cellar. And he's basically wining and dining them. He wants them to get used to the royal lifestyle, to live the high life. And they're like, woohoo, this is great. Especially when he contrasted that siege we went through. This is really pretty amazing. And that's what he wants them to experience. And they were to be trained for 3 years. So you got a 3-year internship. You got a training program. You're going to get educated. You're going to get your master's degree. You're going to get your absolute best training that money can buy. And it's all provided to you for free. Absolutely amazing. And at that time, they were to attend the king. They were to be the king's right-hand guys. They were to be there to serve whatever he needed done. They were going to do it. And we're not talking, you know, cleaning the restrooms in the palace. We're talking important functions for the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. And he mentions among them from the Judahites were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. There were other young men, but our story focuses on these four. And the chief eunuch, That official, Ashpenaz, gave them names, new names. He says, I'm going to call Daniel. He's going to become now Belteshazzar, which are our Babylonian names. Shadrach is going to be changed, is the Babylonian name for Hananiah. Mishael becomes Meshach, and Azariah becomes Abednego. Now, what you need to understand at this point in the story so far, and that's all the further we're going to go in the text today, but he picked young people who were moldable and influence, malleable. They were from royal family and nobility. They were smart. They were sharp. And he looked for physical perfection, high intelligence, etc. He wants to strengthen his own kingdom. And he wants to exploit them and use them to his own advantage. Now, he has several methods of influence. We've already seen he fills their minds with his Babylonian thinking, pagan thinking. By the way, not all of their wisdom was bad. I mean, they had some incredible scientific, technological insights, and their literature was absolutely amazing. But not all of it was. Some of it was really bad stuff. So there's philosophy, there's ways of thinking, there's religious views. They're just being immersed in a Babylonian ways and worldview. Then we come, he fills them with their food. So this is daily life, wining and dining them, getting them used to living the high life in the king's palace. And then he gives them pagan names. And as I said before, Daniel, which these are Hebrew names. Daniel means God is my judge. His name gets changed to Belteshazzar, which means Baal provides. Baal's the foreign god. It's another name for Marduk, which was the chief god and the one that Nebuchadnezzar worshipped above all others. Baal provides. He's your provider. Remember where all this good stuff comes from. It comes from Baal. Not God is my judge. Hananiah means the Lord. Yahweh is gracious. He gets changed, his name gets changed to Shadrach, which is the command or the teaching of Aku. Now you're going to be devoted to following Aku, another major god of the Babylonians. Mishael, which means who is what God is? Who is what God is? His name gets changed to Meshach, which is who is what Aku is. Forget about that old god of yours. Here's a new one, new and improved. And then finally, Azariah, which means the Lord has helped me. Yahweh, the God of Israel has helped me, gets changed to Abednego, which means in the service of Nego, the service of this other major deity of the Babylonians. Now you're under a new master. All of these things, the minds, the education, the literature, the food, the treatment, and the names are all to erase all their history, all their identity with their, and all their memories of the land of Israel, and to reintroduce them and to reorient their entire lives to a Babylonian way of thinking. So essentially, abandon God, the Lord God Yahweh, and embrace the new gods that we're introducing to you. And that's where your life is going to have amazing success. And I'm sure it was all very, very heady stuff. The goal being to obliterate the past and to establish new identities and new loyalties. And I'm telling you guys, this was incredible pressure, incredible temptation. It was going to be really hard. You read these first seven verses and you're saying, how are they ever going to survive? I mean, you read it, and you read, it starts off the worst possible way, and it's like, wow, this is getting worse by the moment. And you're thinking, all hope is gone, all hope is lost. And we come to the next verse, which we'll get to next weekend, when Daniel and his friends stand strong in their faith in the one true God, but not in a obstinate or a kind of in-your-face way, but in a very savvy way. They hold on to their faith, and we're going to learn through the next 12 chapters of Daniel that they not only hold on to their faith, they become incredibly influential in the strange new world they find themselves in. So at the beginning, you're like, okay, so this is Nebuchadnezzar trying to influence them. And in the end, it is Daniel and his friends who influence Nebuchadnezzar, and not just Nebuchadnezzar, but all of Babylon, and not just all of Babylon, but the entire future of the world. That's what we're talking about here, guys. That is what we're talking about. So who influences whom? And so all of this book is just an incredible encouragement for all of us who are trying to walk faithfully with Jesus, the God of the Old and New Testaments, that we want to keep following him faithfully, but we feel this pressure, we feel this temptation, we feel it in our relationships, we feel it with our families, and we're like, are we going to be able to be faithful? And could we ever even make a difference? And the answer is, the book of Daniel is a resounding yes and yes. You can be faithful and you can make a huge difference and be an influencer. You can do something in this world that is absolutely remarkable. And you can be a strong, dedicated follower of Jesus and make a huge difference in your neighborhood, in your relationships, in your workplace, in your community, and in your nation and world. That's what I'm telling you. So, this is a strange new world we're in. This is a book of great encouragement. Buckle your seatbelt, because it's going to be quite a ride. But I want to give you some principles. Some of you are thinking, man, are we going to have any points to take away? And the answer is absolutely yes. I'm going to give you 10 of them, actually. All right? So here we go. Okay, first, let's talk about a strange new world. There's three principles I want to give to you about living in a strange new world, which all of us, to some degree or another, feel like we're living in. All right? Who knows what's going to happen? It's 2024. I never saw this coming. I never saw a lot of stuff coming. But we're living in a strange new world. What's the principle you want to learn about living in a strange new world? First thing is this. The culture, whatever culture we're a part of, is always chasing something and discipling you toward its goals. The culture is always chasing something and is discipling you, training you, teaching you toward its goals. It wants you to achieve something for its goals. So Nebuchadnezzar was chasing, world domination, and he had his own personal goals. He had goals for his culture, and our culture is pursuing different things too. And there's all sorts of values. And by the way, not every one of the cultural values is totally evil and bad. I mean, there were some good things about Babylon. There were a lot of bad things about it too. And this is true of any culture. But the culture is always chasing something. They're pursuing something. In America, we pursue what? Liberty or freedom or, success, whatever it is. And there's this just cultural drink that we're given. We're wined and dined by our culture to conform and to come along, and it's discipling us. I don't think this is some kind of conspiratorial plot. It's not like somebody's, back there, maybe there is somebody, but it's not some kind of conspiratorial plot. It's just the way culture works. I mean, every culture does this around the world. And they're discipling you. They're enculturating you to embrace the values of the culture. And, if your culture is amazing and completely aligned with Jesus Christ, which no culture ever has been, but if it were, then that would be fine. But to the extent that the culture does not embrace the values of Jesus, it's discipling you in a different direction. And again, there's no villain back there twirling his mustache who is necessarily behind all of this. It's just that this is the way it works. And the culture has goals, and they want you to become something. And they're not aligned with Jesus Christ in many times. I mean, we'll talk about all of these in the days to come, but just for your awareness, if you don't recognize this first point, I got a word for you. I got a word, a name to give you. And the name is, you are a fool. F-O-O-L, fool. If you don't think that you're influenced at all by all the stuff that you're surrounded with on a daily basis, the social media, the just the air that we breathe, the moral, ethical, spiritual air that we breathe, the values of the day, the thoughts of the spirit of the age, you're just foolish. It just happens. And it's just to be on the alert, not be paranoid, but just be on the alert to say, is this really the way of Jesus? Is this the way of the Lord? Because the culture wants to rename you from Daniel, God's my judge, to Belteshazzar, Baal provides. This thing's going to provide for me. It's going to be my provider. You know where we're going with this? Okay, second principle about living in a strange new world. Chaos breeds fear-mongering, fighting, and false hope. Three big F's here, all right? I got three F words for you. Fear-mongering, fighting, and false hope. What do I mean by this? Guys, anytime there's like an upset in a culture, like things are kind of changing rapidly, and like there feels like there's this cultural kind of give and take and push and pull, culture war, whatever you want to call it, there's chaos. What's going to prevail? Who's going to win? Who's going to be victorious? And when you get in that kind of chaos, which we certainly are as a culture right now, one of three things begins to invade our hearts if we're not careful. And well-meaning people sometimes, even people who are Christians, will resort to tempting us, not intentionally, but unintentionally, trying to get us to move in a certain direction. And three primary things are used. One is fear-mongering. Whoever it is, well-meaning people or not well-meaning people, they want you to be afraid, terrified of what might happen, and to live your life just dreading the future, really not looking forward to your life. And this fear-mongering has all, all of social media, much of it is just feeding the fear of people. The second one is fighting. This is feeding the anger of people. So there's so much that tells you to get mad, get even, get angry, get violent, get whatever, because you're losing something, they're taking it away. And I'm not saying that powers aren't at work in evil, wrong ways in the society in which we live in. You'd be a fool not to know that. But the answer isn't necessarily to just get raging mad all the time. All right? That might not be your best move. I'm not saying there's never a place for, you know, moral fortitude. And even to say, I'm absolutely opposed to that. That's fantastic and great. Courage is a good virtue. But just generally speaking, just constantly fighting people and battling with people and yelling at people and screaming at people, and this kind of polarization isn't really maybe the way of Jesus. And it isn't the way of Daniel when we're going to unfold this book together over the next 14 weeks. And then the third one is false hope. And that is when people offer to you solutions to this chaos. And if you just do this, buy this, move here, elect him or her, choose this pathway, everything will be fine. All the chaos will be over. And so what we're tempted to do is to put our hope, and it's really a false hope, in bank accounts, in political movements, in technology, in a relationship, in, if I could just have this thing, if I could just acquire this or experience that, and it can be moral, ethical things, it can be all sorts of choices out there, and they're all trying to be your God. And actually, they may be very good things, but very good things make very bad gods because they're not in control. They have no power. Things aren't alive, and they can't give you life. Dead things can't give you life. So beware of false hopes that people offer to you, movements offer to you. The only person that we can have hope in is the God of the Scriptures. Jesus Christ, the fulfillment of every Old Testament promise, including many in the book of Daniel, which we'll see in the days and weeks to come. So chaos breeds fear-mongering, make you afraid, fighting, make you mad, and false hope, make you believe that something other than God is going to be the answer. Not true. Our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. Ultimately, we come back to the cross again and again and again and again and again. And that is our hope, the kingdom of Jesus. Okay, keep going. This strange new world we live in. Just know this, that the seven deadly sins of this strange new world are the seven deadly sins that have been around forever. And cultures change and go, but the seven deadly sins, which were identified by theologians centuries ago, but reflected in the Scriptures, they are the following. And you can write them down. These are the ones we all struggle with, me included. First one is pride. I renamed it self-centeredness because I think that's a little more common usage. So just, it's about me. It's about what I want. It's about me. And I'm proud of me. I'm focused on me. Even if I don't think highly of myself, it's all about me. It's just center on self, selfishness. Then greed, just the acquisition of material stuff is going to make me happy. Lust, sexual immorality, feeding my heart, my mind, my eyes with just sensual pleasures that are outside the bounds of God. Envy, this is jealousy, this is bitterness, this is grudge holding, this is wanting what other people have, not totally dissatisfied, okay? Binging, the old translation is gluttony, but it just really means overindulgence. And I thought, what's a good 21st century word for gluttony? And it's binging. And that could be anything. It could be binging on food. It could be binging on entertainment. It could be binging on whatever. And we just overdo it. It's a natural God-given desire or appetite, but it just gets way out of hand. And it just gets taken out of extremes. Okay, then there's anger, wrath, whether it's simmering hostility or it's just rage, could be any end of that kind of spectrum. And then idleness or laziness, the old translation, sloth. It's just like procrastination, not really having a get-to-it kind of mentality, not willing to work hard. It's just idleness, just sitting around waiting for something to happen and not really being active in your life. So any of these seven things, which we're going to get to all in the book of Daniel, all of these we can fall prey to. And it's just something to be aware of in our strange new world we live in, okay? Daniel was, and he overcame all these seven deadly sins. And so can you. It's true, all right? So how do you thrive in a strange new world? I'm going to give you seven quick principles here. Knock these off quickly, okay? Number one, build unwavering faith in God's all-powerful sovereignty. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon laid siege to Jerusalem, and the sky is falling. And it was. It was a bad day. But the Lord, verse 2, the Lord was behind it all. And there's not one thing that happens in your life or in mine, not one success, not one failure, not one king that rises or falls, not one movement that happens or doesn't happen. Nothing happens on this earth that catches God by surprise. And is he thinking, what in the world's going on down there? God's totally in control. Human beings have responsibility. They make choices for which they are responsible and accountable to God. But overarching everything for the believer is that God is in control. And I just think a lot of fear-mongering, a lot of fighting, and a lot of false hope arises out of not really building your faith that God is all-powerful and totally sovereign. That means he is watching out for us. He has our back. Doesn't mean that bad things can't happen. Oftentimes it means that bad things will happen, but God has not forgotten you or me. And the more, we'll see this throughout the book, the more you can just ground your life in faith in God's all-powerful sovereignty. My God reigns. Jesus is victor. He has conquered sin and death through his cross and resurrection. Nothing can overcome Jesus. All those lessons we learn in Revelation about his kingdom that will never end. All of those things, I'm telling you, this is what you have to ground your everyday life in. Not a far off, yeah, I believe all that stuff. No, this is where you go to every single day of your life. You wake up in the morning saying God is all powerful and he is completely sovereign. And it orders the rest of my day. And it orders the rest of my week and my month and my year and my life. That's what we're saying here. And by the way, how do I know that God is absolutely all powerful and sovereign? I want to tell you something. We're going through a crazy time right now with everything that's happening. I mean, we got health challenges with Ruth. We've got, amazing stuff that God's doing here at Valley Church. I mean, wow. And then in the midst of all this, we had a baby granddaughter born, and we had Easter weekend, and we had the Make Room initiative, and just unbelievable blessings. And then Ruth and I decided now would be a good time to move. And so crazy, we are selling our house. We have moved into an apartment while we get ready to build a house. It's more accessible for Ruth. And so right now we're living in an apartment. It's great. We love it. Wonderful. But I got a call from my neighbor, who's a good friend. He's watching out for me. He says, hey, the guys that are doing some of the painting and the little bit of renovation you're doing before you put it on the market. Yeah. Well, one of their trucks, here's the picture of the truck. One of these guys just backed up and ran over the neighborhood mailbox. And so now the neighborhood mailbox, which is 12 of the houses in our neighborhood. So I'm sure all the neighbors are just gonna love us. Fortunately, we don't live there right now, so they can't yell at us, but they just knocked this down. So anyway, so I'm texting with my neighbor, oh, how can you do it? And guess what happened? Here's what happened. Just keep it there. So my neighbor, who's a wonderful Christian man, he meets up with the postal carrier. And the postal carrier is a really nice, amazing guy. He says, I'm on it. And within a few hours, a maintenance guy from the U.S. Postal Service came back, and then we can see the final picture. He put it back in place. I'm telling you, this wasn't changing water into wine, but in terms of miraculous things, for that to happen within the span of an hour by the United States federal government is nothing short of miraculous, in my opinion. Jesus reigns. Somehow it got fixed in like that. How did that happen? It was just a little bit of encouragement. God had to happen. And sometimes it is little things, my friends. It's not the big, huge deals of what happens, nationally, internationally. It's just the mailbox is back and everybody's happy. And you know what? God just sprinkles little things like that to keep us encouraged. So build unwavering faith in God's all-powerful sovereignty, even over a mailbox on Summit Drive in Clive, Iowa, Jesus reigns. Okay, keeps going. Number two, develop biblically grounded street smarts. This is what Daniel had. He was grounded in the scriptures and his faith in God, but he was also savvy. He knew when to push it and when to back off. He knew when to confront and when to let it go. And a lot of people in our sometimes even in the church, and sometimes especially in the church, they just don't have street smarts. Either it's one or the other. They're either biblically grounded, but they're like, they just don't know how to live it out in everyday real life with people that don't agree with them. Or they just compromise and just give away their faith and compromise their faith because they're just worldly wise. So we got to have both biblical grounding and street smarts, applying biblical grounded faith to just everyday living, especially in a culture where a lot of people don't agree with us. This is what we're going to learn in the book of Daniel. So develop your biblically grounded street smarts. Third principle is find the right hills to die on. You're going to learn that there are like first tier, absolute, most important values, and then there are secondary values, and then there are things that are just kind of convictions, and then things that are just preferences. And we have to be able to sort through theologically, culturally, personally, what are the hills that we're going to die on? Because sometimes we just end up either not dying for the hills that we should die on, or we're just dying on too many hills. We think this is the end of the world, and if I don't make a last stand here, everything's going to go terrible. And it's just like, guys, we got to step back. And Daniel, throughout this book, is a great model of, you know what? That one, I don't need to worry about. This one is worth drawing a line in the sand. And we're going to learn savvy to do that. But I'm telling you, to thrive in a strange new world, got to find the right hills to die on. Okay, fourth, you got to believe that conviction and influence must coexist. Daniel had absolute convictions about his faith and also was an incredibly influential person in the kingdom of Babylon, in a foreign, ungodly, pagan-worshipping world. He thrived in that. Spiritually, he thrived in his faith in God, and also he was an influencer in that culture. So those aren't necessarily contradictory. They can coexist. In fact, they must coexist. To whatever degree possible, we obviously can never compromise our faith, but we can be way more influential with some street smarts and some biblical grounding. Okay, number five, treat outsiders with wisdom, respect, and courage. One of the things that's going to intrigue me and intrigues me as I study the book of Daniel is how he interacts with Nebuchadnezzar and with the officials. And he just, it's street smarts, but it's biblical wisdom. It's respect for them. He doesn't pick fights with them. He doesn't demean them. He doesn't, you know, ridicule them. He actually respects them. He doesn't agree with them, but he treats them with respect and courage. He wasn't afraid, and he was unashamed of his faith. These are the lessons we learn from Daniel. We have to treat the people who are outside the faith, which is now the majority in America, with wisdom, respect, and courage. All three of those together. Number six, discover your unique divine assignment. So UDA, unique divine assignment. We're going to talk about more about this in the days to come. Every one of us has certain experiences, certain heart, certain giftedness, and just places where God allows us to be. And it might be in the workplace, it might be in a relationship, but it's just, it's unique to you. Not everybody is going to be like Daniel and end up third in the empire. Only one person gets to be number three in the Babylonian empire. His name is Daniel. But a lot of other people were living for God then too. So every one of us has a kind of unique calling. And what we're to do is to maximize that unique divine assignment. And we got to discover that, and then we got to maximize it. All right? More to come. But I want you to begin praying about, what does God have for me in this strange new world? Where does he want me to serve, to love, to make a difference? We're coming up on Lovey Des Moines Days. Absolutely. Jump in, find a divine, you know, path in that where you say, I could serve with my gifts here and influence our community for good. That's what we're talking about. Okay. And we'll expand more on that in days to come. Number seven, last one, follow God in a lifetime relationship, not as a short-term project. The book of Daniel goes on for a long time. There's a lot of crazy apocalyptic stuff that we'll get to. There's a lot of incredible, powerful stories of courage and commitment and overcoming long shot odds and some miracles. I mean, just amazing stuff. But the thing that strikes me about the book of Daniel is it starts with a 15-year-old kid, basically, an exile, a foreigner, a refugee, really. And, you know, just in some ways a prisoner of war. And it goes over the course of the next 70 years. And he sees, not only does he see Babylonian kings come and go, he sees the Babylonian Empire come and go. and he sees another empire rise to take its place. And what I'm telling you is, it's a lifetime of following God. We gotta see this as a marathon, not as a sprint. It's not gonna all get solved in 30 minutes. But we begin to embed in our heart these values, and God's gonna do amazing things. Okay, I'm gonna stop here, except to say this. Here is the one little giveaway of how I know God's at work in powerful ways, through this book. So, you had this Jehoiakim, and then he gets besieged by Nebuchadnezzar, and then he goes down, and guess what? It looks like it's all over. Until it doesn't. I'll give you a little sneak peek into things to come. You turn to Matthew's gospel, and it opens with a genealogy. You with me? And in Matthew chapter 1, we get this genealogy of how Jesus Christ came into the world. And you get Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac fathered Jacob, and Jacob fathered Judah. There's Judah. That's our kingdom we're from, right? Keep going down. And then verse 11 says, and Josiah fathered Jeconiah, known as Jehoiakim, and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. Wait, what? You mean Jesus descended from the likes of these unfaithful followers of Judah, kings that got conquered? You thought at the time it was all over. But what God was just getting started. He said the best is yet to come. And that is always the message of the scriptures. The best is yet to come. We can thrive in a strange new world. Father in heaven, thank you for everybody here. I can't wait to see what you do in the lives and hearts of so many of us. And if we are on this incredible ride as a church, we're seeing awakening, we're seeing new believers, we're seeing spiritual growth. And in some ways, it's unprecedented in the life of our church. Father, thank you for that. May you continue to prepare us for just a bold new day for all of us, me included, everybody who's hearing this. We worship you, we give you all the glory, and we always, always, always come back to the gospel, to your cross, to your resurrection, Lord Jesus, because from that and through that and for that we live. And all God's people agreed and said, amen, amen. God bless you all. See you soon.